Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Welcome to Week to Week, the political roundtable program from the Commonwealth Club of California for Friday, March 14th, 2014. Thanks for joining us today. I'm John Zipper, the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial, and your host for today's program. As always, we'll look into providing some insight in some of the top issues of the past couple weeks. And any opinions expressed here are those solely of the speakers and not necessarily those of the Commonwealth Club, its members, guests, or supporters. Now let's meet our panelists for today. I'm going to start on the far end of the stage there. Dr. Larry Gersten is a professor of political science at San Jose State University, NBC Bay Area's political analyst, and the author of Not So Golden After All, The Rise and Fall of California. He's on Twitter at L. Gersten. Next to him is Carla Marinucci, the senior political writer at the San Francisco Chronicle. She's on Twitter as C. Marinucci. If you want to know how to spell it, you can find it on those sheets there. And next to me is Bill Whalen, a research fellow at the Hoover Institute at Stanford, and he's on Twitter as Hoover Whalen. So please use the question cards that are spread around throughout the seats. Submit your questions. We'll try to get as many of them answered during the program as we can. So let's get right to our first topic, which is California Senator Dianne Feinstein created a bit of a stir this week on the floor of the U.S. Senate, making some accusations against the CIA. Kind of have to be brave to do that. But Carla, set the table for us. What did she say? Why has this caused such a big stir?
Well, Feinstein, who has been one of the biggest defenders of the CIA and the NSA, she delivered a bombshell, a 45-minute bombshell from the Senate floor, and the entire Capitol watched. The accusations were that the CIA has not been straightforward with regard to investigations going back to 2002 with regard to waterboarding. She really laid it out there and talked about how the investigation has been undermined. Raised issues of almost constitutional crisis, some people said, separation of powers. It was huge. And here in the Bay Area, we heard a lot of people, and even John Stewart, saying hypocrisy. Look, she defended the NSA when they were going after average people's emails, but then she got really upset when they went after the Senate.
First they went after the average person, but I wasn't an average person, so I didn't worry.
Exactly. Her polls have suffered here in the Bay Area, and she's at a historic low, 43% in the polls. And this issue has yet to be played out. It's going to be very interesting, but no question about it. She hit them broadside this week.
Yeah. Bill, what?
Well, it's interesting. She started out by criticizing the CIA, by suggesting that the CIA was out of bounds by going into hacking into her Senate aides' computers and taking back documents they'd taken away, which causes CIA to push back and say, well, the Senate aides took documents, they didn't. There is a report coming down the pike from Leon Panetta, who's been studying the various activities over the Bush years in terms of enhancement programs, and it'll be a big, big, ugly debate come this fall. But what stood out here, as Carla mentioned, was Senator Feinstein came to the floor and attacked the CIA, and by default also went after the Bush administration, and the pushback here in San Francisco could not be more furious against her as a hypocrite, some say lapdog of the CIA, enabler, and so forth. And I think, she's in probably her final term in the Senate here. She's up in 2018. She'll be 85 years old at that time. I'm not sure she's going to run again for another term, but this issue is not going away between now and 2018.
And this, the focus of her, the focus of these investigations, this is all stuff, this is relitigating the Bush administration,
correct,
is it not? Larry, is this worth bringing up now? Is this a constitutional problem worth fighting over?
Well, I think from her standpoint, it certainly is.
Sure.
I think it's important, at least to me, Congress is running around with a pretty big inferiority complex these days. Whatever you want to say about whether the Obama administration is doing good, doing bad, it's a very activist administration. And Congress feels, Republicans, of course, more than Democrats, but even Democrats, like, holy smokes, what's left for us? And, you know, why does she not get too upset when it's the public's information that's being snooped versus Congress? Well, now we're talking about a co-equal branch of the government.
Right.
Don't step on that. And I think that's what got her buzzed more than anything else. And, you know, if in fact the CIA deleted information from computers and kept the committee from doing its work, she's got a point. So I think this is a story that has to play out.
And I think another interesting aspect of this is where it puts President Obama, between a rock and a hard place, between one of his own appointees, John Brennan, and one of his strongest supporters in the Senate. Where does that go? How does he handle it? Within minutes of her speech, Brennan was out there having to just,
But he flat out said no. We didn't
flat out said no. But
I think what it also means is in theory, 2016 should be a referendum on the Obama years. This is how it plays in politics. After 8 years, one president, the two candidates reflect on what that candidate did well, and the president did well and didn't do. In theory, the 2016 election should be a referendum on Barack Obama. But what you're going to see, this issue is not going away. We're going to have a discussion about what happened in the Bush years. So this is going to force the 2016 Republicans and Democrats now to revisit the wonderful days of waterboarding and what was done in the previous administration.
Someone asked, why the Bay Area backlash against DFI? You mentioned a couple of reasons for it. Is this something that can really cause a trouble for her, or are the folks who've had a problem with her on the CIA, and has that always been kind of in the background and she can roll over them anytime anyway?
You know, when you are in office as long as she is, you begin to accrue enemies. Even if you're doing so many things right. You know, you gain a few on the left, you gain a few on the right, you here, there. And, you know, she's been in office since 1990. That is a very long time. It's interesting that her popularity has dropped more than Boxer's. Boxer came at the same time. And I think a lot of that now, layered over what I just said, is the fact that she has been very defensive of the CIA and the other intelligence agencies. And, you know, there's a lot of suspicion about that in the Bay Area. And I think that sort of lays over all the other things. But she's just getting enemies because she's been around a long time.
Yeah, I mean, as Bill said, she's unlikely to run for another term. She's the oldest member of the Senate right now. But the fact is, you're right, she's gotten a lot of pushback from the Bay Area. I mean, Code Pink had a helicopter outside her house, which she actually said she thought was a drone. She'd kind of been in support of the drone program. Mm-hmm. People have raised this issue on NSA, but the fact is, these accusations this week were really important because if the oversight committee, if Senate can't do the oversight on the spies, then what kind of problems are we having?
You have a longer head, though. You're having the Senate, the Congress saying, we can't trust the CIA. The CIA is pushing back by going to the FBI and saying, wait a second, we can't trust Congress, which A, leaks like a sieve, and B, we can't trust these people looking into our files. So, rock and hard place.
And it's always been an awkward relationship, this idea of the Intelligence Committee.
Right.
And how it is really, it's the only cloth, if you will, between whatever the administration does and Congress. And everybody in Congress is asked basically to put their faith in these 16 people, eight from each house. And so I think Feinstein feels like, you know, I'm not only defending my committee, I'm defending the integrity of this branch of government.
And is that, do you think, how she completes that circle, if you will, of the criticism of hypocrisy? Yes, we've got this domestic stuff going on,
right,
but the reason she feels comfortable in defending it is because she thinks her committee is able to
But
combined.
The suggestion is perhaps some other Democrat, perhaps Ron Wyden, the senator from Oregon, is much more outspoken about domestic surveillance. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's the right message, but she's the wrong messenger.
Okay. Let's move on to another Democrat who has some Democrats mad at him in this case, and that is Governor Jerry Brown. He actually had some hecklers when he was speaking at the Democratic convention. Larry, what is Jerry Brown confronting with this whole fracking controversy?
You know, fracking is this sort of fractured hydraulic drilling where, you know, they shove a lot of water and other chemicals under pressure into the ground to dislodge oil, tars, and whatnot, and get it out. It's been done in a number of states. It's been done in California for some time, but it's always been vertical.
Okay.
Now the question is, can we do it horizontally? And that's where it gets dicey for some people. Look, we got a problem here. On the one hand, California's got an awful lot of this stuff, more than any other state. There's an energy potential that's beyond belief. Of course, it's carbon fuel. That's another story. And the other side of it is a lot of people who believe that there are environmental consequences all the way from earthquakes to polluted water. The answers are not entirely clear. We've seen examples of both of those things, but the question is it an oddity or is it something that happens along with fracking? So I think Brown is trying to find middle ground between the environmentalists on the one hand and energy producers and consumers on the other. I think it's a tough place to be, and I think he's probably done as good a job with it as anybody can do. Let's take it slow. Let's do some examining. Let's do some studying. I know that's not going to please the environmentalists. I know that's not going to please the people who want to produce it, which probably tells me that he's probably doing about the right thing.
But you know, here we get another rock and hard place situation. Here's the governor who talks about climate change being, you know, the number one issue in this state. So I covered the state Democratic convention last week, and he got up to speak, and immediately, you know, hundreds of Democrats are in the audience with signs, another Democrat against fracking. He got heckled at this convention. And then came Tom Steyer, the billionaire Democratic activist right after him, who said, fracking, oh no, we're not going there. And he suggested, look, if it takes two-thirds of a vote to pass new taxes, every community should have a two-thirds margin to have any kind of fracking. So, and he put that on. That got huge applause with Democrats. So Jerry Brown is facing a lot of blowback within his own party on this issue of fracking. It's clear the Democratic grassroots does not want this. He's already indicated his support of it.
You see this in other issues, too. A good example is education. Mm-hmm. Daryl Steinberg, the leader of the state Senate, wants to expand preschool, use surplus money to do that. The governor doesn't want to do that. The governor's more in the rainy day fund. So you see push and pull between the governor and his constituents.
And, you know, that isn't the only issue that Jerry Brown took some flack for the Democratic Convention. And I don't know if we're going to get into this right now, but why not? Legal pot. The Democrats at their convention passed a platform that said we're going to legalize, or, you know, we support the legalization and regulation of pot, like alcohol and tobacco. Now, just a week before on Meet the Press, Jerry Brown said, look, how many stoners can you have in a state before things start to go south? You know, and basically that's sort of what he said.
I guess he's never seen those photos of Barack Obama.
I don't know if you're talking about California. I think that genie's out of the bottle a long time ago, but okay. The fact is that look, looking at the polls, the Democrats, 62%, two-thirds of Democrats support legal pot. They're looking at Colorado, where by 2015, this is going to be a $500 million business, legal pot. In California, you got huge unions like the United Food and Commercial Workers. They've already got 1,000 people working in the cannabis industry, and they're looking at, oh, legalized? Wow, that'll be a lot more. Unions have a stake in this. So I think this is just a matter of time. When you're looking at the numbers and the jobs and the push for this here in California and the taxes and what this can do, I mean, the tourism business in Colorado, California legislators are watching that and going, you know,
so
we want
drawing,
a piece of that action.
So if you're drawing up the Gavin Newsom campaign for 2018, you have that leaf as sort of your campaign logo,
and see,
right?
And that brings you, you're exactly right, to the next generation of California politicians, because it was Gavin Newsom at the convention who brought this up and said, you know, this isn't about stoners. That was a direct jab to Jerry Brown. This is about an issue about regulation, that even if you're not for legal pot, you should get behind, because, look, it's already basically legal in the state. So Newsom is sort of leading the way on this, as he's done on marriage equality issues, and you're looking at him sort of shaping what he's going to be doing for the future. But in all cases, is Jerry Brown sort of the old way, and then you've got some of these younger politicians talking about the new way?
I think there's two caveats here, Carla. One, when we think of the Democratic convention and the Republican convention, state convention, but both of them really, we're not talking about everyday regular Democrats and everyday regular Republicans. We're talking about folks out there, right? Out there on the left, out there on the right, you know, they're homeless practically, let's go in here. And And I mean, I think you know, they don't really reflect the tenor of the mainstream of either party.
It's a great irony that the two parties' conventions represent really the worst manifestations of what the other party says about the other one.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and that's the first thing. The second thing is, when you talk about the polls here, I've been doing polling for a long time, and there's always this question of intensity. Okay, and I don't believe there's a great deal of intensity on this issue. There's intensity on the choice issue? You bet. Is there intensity on the same-sex marriage? You bet. Is there intensity on this issue? I'm not so sure. I'm not so persuaded. Do you think it's an idea? Yeah, let's do it. I don't think there's a lot of who can be intense like that. I think Colorado. This is what's wonderful about the states. States are laboratories. Massachusetts was the laboratory with health insurance. Now, nobody admits that anymore, especially if you're Romney, but it was. Yeah. You know, and other states, Oregon was the laboratory for death with dignity. Colorado is now, more than any other state, the laboratory with the legalization of marijuana. And I think a lot of people are going to sit back for a while and just see how it all shapes out.
We've talked, before we came out here, we were talking about Governor Brown writing, I mean, he's, we can all answer this in unison. Will he win re-election?
So he's healthy and walking.
Well, if we're talking about a candidate who has some capital to burn, he can afford to lose a few voters. I mean,
right.
Do these issues matter? The fact that he's not with his party on, you know.
I think any of the three Browns, like Jerry, Ann, or Sutter, could probably be elected governor at this point. what it ties into, though, is that there's a disconnect between the governor and more rank and file Democrats. Is a word that was thrown around at that convention. That's complacency and excitement and buzz. And this ties into that vote in Florida earlier this week. And what you saw, there was not.
Why don't you explain what
In Florida, in the 13th congressional district, they had a special election to fill a vacancy. A Republican congressman had died. And the Democrats really lined this up as best as they could. They ran a woman who had run previously for governor and narrowly lost, and she carried that district in that race. She was Florida's chief financial officer, which is an elected position. The Democrats outspent the Republicans about 4-1. Bill Clinton, the save artist of Democratic campaigns, came in to campaign for her, and they ran against a Republican who was a lobbyist. Now, maybe the voters in this district don't get Netflix and they don't watch House of Cards, but if I were drawing up the perfect opponent to run against, I think a Washington lobbyist, not just a lobbyist, but somebody who had just left his wife and was campaigning with a much younger girlfriend on top of this. You cannot drop an easier campaign for them to win, and come election night, they managed to lose the district by about 2 points. And this showed a lot of things that got into question of the potency of Obamacare versus the ability to kind of deflect from it. But what you saw numerically was that Barack Obama carried the district in 2012, and she lost it. There's about a 4% drop-off between the president's performance in 2012 and her performance. If Democrats are underperforming versus Barack Obama in 2014, they're in a lot of trouble in congressional races.
And you know, this is only just one of the races where Democrats have to worry. I mean, this was raised last week. Look, in this state, they own the state, right? They have all the statewide offices. They have both houses. But the fact is, in the recent San Diego mayor's race, a city that went two-thirds for Barack Obama, they just elected a Republican. That was a city where Labor put $4 million into the Democratic candidate. They just elected a Republican. So what does that tell you? That Republicans have one thing going for them in this midterm that the Democrats don't have, and that is anger. They have somebody to be angry at. It's Obama. And Obamacare. And they have more motivation. And in the Florida race, in the San Diego mayor's race, where the Republican Party says they showed they are getting their stuff together in California. They're getting the boots on the ground. They're getting the get out to vote machine going. And the Democrats may be sitting back and saying, hey, we don't need to vote. What's the, you know, we have it all in the bag. And if that's the case on all these statewide races, they may have some trouble.
Well, you could argue that both ways. One is that this was an early wake-up call that they realized that, okay, therefore they have to get ginned up because...
Right. And historically there are disconnects between what happens in the spring and what happens in November.
Yeah. It's true. Yeah. But, you know, there was another state Senate race in the Central Valley just a couple of months ago, and yes. Andy Vidak won that, and that's a Republican. That was a seat that flipped from Democrat to Republican. So I mean, this is where Democrats are starting to get a little nervous. Like, they've got to get out their vote. They've got to get their people motivated to vote in California, where they already own
everything. It's a tough night for Nancy Pelosi. She wants to be the speaker again. She needs 17 seats, and this is one she needed to gain.
Yeah.
You look around the country, and I think there are only about 7 or 8 toss-up districts in which Republicans are in trouble. So it's hard to see her to get to 17 right now.
Does anyone seriously think she has a chance of returning to the speaker's
seat? She does.
Seriously, do you think she seriously thinks that, or
no,
just
I think it's going to be very, very hard for her to do that.
I think it's kind of important to remember that this is not about Obama. It's not about Obamacare. It's about the structure of the system. And the fact of the matter is, in off-year elections, the turnout is always lower. Always lower. And when the turnout is lower, those 4 to 6 points, it is disproportionately the Democrats who do not come out to vote.
Why is that?
Because the Democrats tend to be less affluent. The Democrats are comprised disproportionately of minorities. And these groups don't mobilize the same way in individual districts, which, by the way, are overwhelmingly gerrymandered. 50% of the House districts are gerrymandered Republican. 10% of the districts are gerrymandered Democrat. So how could we not expect, without any of these other intervening variables, how could we not expect Congress in 2014 to come out Republican, perhaps even with a few more seats in the House, and I think maybe the Senate? But I'll tell you one thing. I think they're sowing their seeds for disaster in 2016.
How is that?
Because to the extent that the Tea Party, you know, flexes its muscles and moves the Republican Party even more to the right, they will set themselves up for an absolute defeat in 2016.
No.
So, I mean, because they don't get it. They don't get it. They don't get that they're so far out of the mainstream.
Now, it was this candidate down in Florida, his last name is Jolly.
David Jolly.
Seriously.
Who is?
Where does he fit on the Republican spectrum? Is he a Tea Party
this
candidate?
This was part of what was interesting to look at here. To his credit, he ran a very smart campaign. He denounced spending in Washington, for example, but said he would have voted for the Republican budget, but he said he would have voted for the debt ceiling increase, but against the Republican budget. He at all times tried to position himself as a Republican, but also deflected from bigger troubles. And he talked very actively about alternatives to Obamacare. He just didn't say repeal, repeal, repeal. He said, here's what I want to do on that front. So tried to, in some ways, defang the Republican challenge. Yeah.
But when we talk about the Tea Party and its effect on the Republican Party, look, we have to look here in California, too, because when we talk about the governor's race here, we're going to the state convention in Birmingham starting tonight, covering that. You know, what a leading candidate is Tim Donnelly, an assemblyman from Southern California. He is a Tea Party favorite. He is a guy who actually, he founded the Minutemen here in California. It's actually set up a lawn chair on the border and helped construct the wall. Not to mention, on gun rights, is a very strong gun rights guy.
We know he has a gun.
And we know he has a gun because he illegally got on a plane with a loaded gun. However, he's got the support of a lot of very strong Republican grassroots activists. And he's in a fight with a much more moderate candidate, Neil Kashkari, who was a Treasury Department official, ran TARP for the TARP program, and has been talking about poverty and issues like that, going out and sleeping in homeless shelters, talking about what do we need to do to create jobs and education.
I don't know at the end of the day if the Donnelly support is as deep as people think. He's not very popular within the legislature, for example. He doesn't have much money. His campaign is in disarray right now. He just lost his campaign manager. But that said, this is a heart and soul fight that the Republicans are going to have to an extent also in 2016. And that Kashkari, who's young, I think he's 40, 41 years old, his first campaign, he's running a campaign whose unstated message is adapt or die. And so he is trying to push the party in more moderate stances, whereas Donnelly is both dug in and has his weapon out ready to shoot those who would push the party in other directions. So the Republicans will have this out in the public stage. And again, I think you're going to see this in 2016 as well, because you have the likes of a Ted Cruz, who seems certain to run, and he's going to be very defiant in his positions. And you're going to see other Republicans, such as a Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio, are going to say, no, we've got to be a little more inclusive here, fellas.
You know, back to Donnelly and Kashkari, which I think is fascinating. I love watching this play out. I think it's great. Donnelly's got $45,000 in his treasury, just lost his campaign manager yesterday. I mean, obviously his campaign's in disarray. This is one of I am not a fan of top two whatsoever, the top two primary system. I'm just not. But the fact of the matter is, it's going to really play havoc with that race.
Right.
Brown will get his votes. You know, the question is, where are the 22% of the independents going to go in the state? All the Democrats aren't going to go with Brown. Yeah, Donnelly will get the lion's share of the Republican vote. But boy, there's an awful lot of folks out there who could cast their vote for Kashkari, and I'm not convinced that he can't come in second. I think there's a shot for him.
He can, but what's interesting about the Kashkari campaign is, let's say he finishes second, now he runs against Governor Brown in the fall. And history, first of all, is against him. Could anybody name, Jerry Brown will be running for his fourth term. Technically, this is his third term, but since 28 years between terms two and three, a lot of voters see it as his first term. Could anybody name the last first-term governor in California to lose in a re-election?
We've got to go way back.
Colbert Olson, 1942.
That's right. The only Democrat elected during a 60-year period.
The only Democrat in a long stretch of Republican governors, and the only atheist governor in California history who got into trouble right away by taking the oath of office and refusing to say, so help me God, and it was kind of downhill from there. That said, we tend to rubber stamp governors. I worked for Pete Wilson in a past life. Pete Wilson was down by 23 points to Kathleen Brown, Jerry's sister, in his reelection, and he won by 15 points. So it's pretty much a stone lock. But the challenge for Kashkari is this. Number one is money. Very simple. You're Republican, you have to go to big donors, and you have to go to the business community. Big donors in California, not as a rule, but you'll find a lot of them out there, are very turned off in California politics. They don't like the caliber of the candidates, and they think the state is just running in a crazy direction. They'd rather spend their money on national campaigns and play in California. And then the second challenge for him is getting within the business community. You notice the business community was very quiet when he had the Proposition 30 fight. Why would that be? Because that was going after income tax, personal income tax. It's like that Far Side cartoon of the two bears in the forest. And the one bear has the rifle scope on him, and what he does, he points to the other bear. And that was the business community in that fight. The individuals getting taxed, not them, so they'd be quiet. And to them, Jerry Brown is their thin line of defense against the legislature and what they see as its excesses. So the business community is not going to be out there to donate for Kashkari. So he will at all times be challenged to raise money and run a campaign that you'll notice. So you're going to see a lot more viral campaigning, a lot more YouTube campaigning, a lot more ways to try to make noise in this social media age of ours. And just, it's truly an uphill challenge.
He picked up $1 million in the first 2 weeks.
Right.
That's not petty cash. This is not going to be a $150 million race like Meg Whitman anyway. And I view him as positioning himself for 2018. He gets a respectable showing. He's a fresh face. He's a young man with new ideas. And I think he positions himself for a great race in 2018.
I mean, I see them going after him in former Goldman Sachs. That's all you have to say in this state a lot of times, and that's going to be hard to get over. A lot of Republicans don't like TARP, didn't like TARP.
And he voted for Obama.
Yeah, and he did. He voted for Obama in 2008. They don't like that. He's not a guy who's had a lot of connection with just traditional Republican politics. But the fact is, what's so fascinating about this year is this top two primary, which is a new system in California and the first time in the statewide races. And I think the whole country's watching it for a lot of reasons. I mean, this is the top two vote getters, whoever they are, of whatever party, go on to compete in the November election, which means you're going to have a lot of Democrats competing against Democrats and in some cases Republicans against Republicans. And it's already created a much more competitive, I think, interesting, lively race, even in the House races.
Well, and one of our audience members asked pretty much the question you just put forth, which is, what does this open primary mean? The top two, how will that affect the intra-party fights,
I mean,
as much as the inter-party?
Let's look at the House race in the Silicon Valley with Mike Honda and Ro Khanna, who's Honda being a seven-term Democrat, who never has faced a challenge or hasn't faced a challenge for more than a decade since he first took that seat. This year, another Democrat, Ro Khanna, who's a former Obama trade representative and a Silicon Valley attorney, has really mounted a very tough challenge. He's already raised four times. He has four times the cash on hand as Honda, and he has the support of a lot of big folks in Silicon Valley, Sheryl Sandberg of Facebook, Marissa Meyer of Yahoo. So Khanna has already challenged Honda to a debate. I mean, Hunt hasn't debated since, I think it's 14 years.
I think since high school.
Yeah, and now normally a seven-term congressman wouldn't even have to debate anybody, but in this two-term system, and I think this is good, by the way. I mean, you know, candidates all around the state.
Spoken by somebody who has stories to need to
write. Right. But, I mean, I see this as I see it as a job interview, and we see these candidates. Dianne Feinstein skated on a debate last time around with her challenger. She just said, I don't want to do it.
Yeah,
and
I think even folks who want to vote for the incumbent, I think many of them still want to see them explain to the constituencies again, why should I have this job? What do I think? Rather than just got in again.
It puts the state parties in an interesting spot, the parties which did not want this to begin with. You take the Secretary of State's race here in California. This is the elections, chief elections official, not John Kerry's job. And you have two Democrats running in this open primary. One is Leland Yee, the senator, state senator from here in San Francisco, and Alex Padilla, who's a state senator from Los Angeles. The Democratic Party does not want to choose favorites in this, so they have to let that race decide itself. That race features those two Democrats, a Republican named Pete Peterson, who's an academic at Pepperdine, and then Dan Schnur, who's a former colleague of mine from the Wilson days, who's a longtime Republican press secretary, who's running as an independent, sort of an outside voice. So you're a voter in this. You can vote for one of the two Democrats who are both attractive. Republican, you can go with tried and trusted with the R at the end of the name. Or if you don't like the status quo, you can go with the independents. It's going to be very fascinating to see which two make that final cut.
You know, I'll say this about Schnur's approach. I really like the fact that he says the Secretary of State's office should not be a partisan office. If there's any office that shouldn't be partisan, it's that one. You know, because you're dealing with campaigns, although it's a moribund office. Nobody's handled it well. It's a disaster record system. I mean, it should be blown up, but that's another story. But I mean, I like the idea of that. But I, you know, at the end of the day, people are going to say what you said the first time. The Secretary of State, is he in charge of foreign relations? Okay, and it will be a partisan vote because it's down the line in races. Nobody knows about it, and fewer people care about it, unfortunately. And in the end, I think it will be a battle between those two Democrats. But it's a wonderful thing to see whether a no political party candidate, that's what they call them now, can gain traction. And Dan Schnur's got a very pleasant style about him. Let's see.
We've talked a little bit here about, you know, tensions within parties and specifically within the Democratic Party. Larry, there's an effort, I guess, in the state legislature to overturn Proposition 209. Set the stage for that. What is it, and why is that a potential problem for the Democrats?
I love disasters. This is a disaster in the making. This is just so exciting for me. I know, it's very sick. You know, the Democrats have done this fabulous job in California of cobbling together a majority of minorities. You know, we mentioned the vote last time. 96% of the African Americans voted for Obama. 73% Asian Americans, 71% Latinos. All these votes were reflected in California similarly. You know, so, I mean, the Democratic coalition of the state has just been flying high. Back to that comment. But here's a situation where disaster looms, and I'll tell you why. Because we passed during the Wilson era a series of propositions and laws that some would consider anti-minority, whether it was English being the official language, whether it was not allowing illegal immigrants to have state benefits of various kinds, and Proposition 209, which basically eliminates affirmative action. California is one of a handful of states that constitutionally eliminates affirmative action, doesn't allow for it. And once that happened, no longer were the universities particularly trying to balance out the applicants. So many Latinos, so many, all qualified, but let's make sure that these guys get in, blah, blah, blah. And since then, Asian Americans have absolutely blossomed. 38% of all students at UC are Asian American. And Asian Americans are about 11% of the population. And so now there's talk among a lot of Democrats, Latinos and others, of eliminating this Proposition 209. In other words, restoring affirmative action. There was a vote on it in the Senate, and the legislature was just about to say, okay, when suddenly these Asian American legislators started catching it from their constituents. Oh, my gosh, we're going to be hurt. So now you got one minority against another minority, and I'm just having fun. Because how do you satisfy all of these groups? How do you and live to the goal of getting the best and the brightest in the university? I don't know how it's going to turn out, but I'm pulling up a chair, you know.
I mean, and it is interesting, and it sort of dramatizes California as this great melting pot. We are so
it's
different.
Boiling over.
Yeah, we are so different from other states. And, you know, when you go to the Honda Kona race, I mean, that district alone, we've talked about this, I mean, the number of Indian Americans, I mean, South Asian population, I mean...
It's only 5%.
Yeah, it's only 5%, but the fact is that they, you know... Most of the South Asians have come here. 85% have come since 1985, and they already have like four times the number of degrees. You know, they have four times the amount of income. Yeah. They have done hugely well in California, and that's exactly the kind of drama you're talking about in terms of college.
Yeah. Well, let me put it in much crasser terms. I'm sitting in for Deborah Saunders, who's the token conservative. I guess I'm the sub-token conservative today. But in very crass terms, initiatives are also about timing. For years, Republicans have looked at the initiative process, and they've tried to put initiatives on primaries. Why? Smaller turnout benefits Republicans. Democrats very cleverly undid that. We don't have initiatives now in the primary. So now you go to the general election. Well, there are two kinds of general elections in California. There's the 2012 and 2008 cycle with Barack Obama, where there's a huge surge in voters. Or you have the 2010-2014 cycle, which isn't as large, and 2014 will be a market drop-off. So from a very crass political standpoint, if I'm going to pass an initiative in California or try to pass an initiative that is a hornet's nest, I need to bump the Democratic vote if I think that's what it takes. I'm putting that on the ballot in 2016 when Hillary Clinton gins the vote in California. Why do it now?
Yeah, here's why. The answer is you've got to get the absolute two-thirds vote.
Uh-huh.
And right now they're close to it. You know, they have a couple, how shall we say this, in purgatory, with Wright and what's his name? Southern California.
Calderon.
Yeah. But, I mean, if they can get back one or two of those votes between now and November and special elections, they've got the two-thirds now to get on. So you're right. You're between a rock and a hard spot again because they've got the votes to get it on now, but 2016 would be a better shot.
So then I'd push back and say, why not put it in 2016, but have an outside group put it on the ballot and take your legislative fingerprints off it?
That's a way to do that. And now you're coming out with an initiative instead of a legislative referendum.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
We mentioned the political parties' conferences, political conventions that they've been holding, or one that's about to start this weekend.
Right.
Carla, set the table. I mean, talk about shows. These are both for good and bad. They're an insight into the parties.
These conventions in California are important for one reason. I mean, they have to. Both parties have to get their activists ginned up for what's ahead, fundraising and in campaigns. So we're going to hear from Condoleezza Rice this weekend in Burlingame. It's going to be interesting what she has to say on Ukraine and other things. And also Rice Priebus, who's the head of the Republican National Committee. Look, Daryl Issa is going to be there. He, as you all know, has just...
Sound check.
Yeah. Jackie Speier and other House Democrats this week have been asking him to apologize from the floor of the House for his actions as House Oversight Committee, shutting off the microphone of other Democrats, not letting them. I mean, he's been very controversial. Yet the Republican faithful love him, and so we're going to be seeing a lot of these kind of things played out. But the people that the Republican faithful won't be hearing from are their own candidates.
Why is that?
Interestingly enough, because I think the party chair Jim Brulte, he's been very much involved in trying to bring this party back from the financial brink, put them on the map, and he has in places like the San Diego race and in the Central Valley race. But he doesn't want to see the storyline, which we in the media love, is circular firing squad in the Republican Party, which almost happens guaranteed at every convention. And I think he's trying to avoid that. So the party faithful will not be hearing from their own candidates, which is a very interesting thing. Now, after we wrote about it, Mr. Donnelly and Kashkari will be able to address them on Sunday. But I mean, after everything's over, at which point, you know, maybe the janitors will be sweeping up, but not a lot of other people.
The gubernatorial front runner is not going to address it until.
Yeah, I mean, none of their statewide candidates get to address. So I think you're going to see the Republican Party has a very big lift here in California, but they argue, and Brulte argues, they've already made a lot of gains. They've gotten themselves out of debt, which was a huge hole to get out of, and now they've won a couple of key races. And they're going to be hearing from House candidates like David Valadao in some very important races that could flip. Look, in the House races, there are endangered species on both sides of the aisle. When you look at Ami Bera in the Sacramento area, boy, the Republicans have him right there in the crosshairs. And David Valadao is on the Republican side. Some of these seats could flip. And so the Republicans need all the help they can get, and they've got those motivated people ready to go to the front lines.
Bill, are you heading to Burlingame for the convention? Do you have your flight?
I've written a lot of speeches. I feel like I've done my time. This was starting out as a really interesting convention, sort of the equivalent of a tree falls in the forest and no one's around to hear it, to see it, does it make sound, the idea of not having candidates speak. And they've done a clever compromise by doing it on Sunday. What happens is if they let the candidates speak on Friday, you know, infighting breaks out. Everybody's supposed to obey Ronald Reagan's commandment and speak nicely to their opponent. Of course, they get up there and completely dump on their opponent, and it just lingers over the convention for the next 2 days. Yeah. Carla presses F5 on her computer and writes her obligatory story on this. So they pushed it to Sunday. But, you know, the problem for the California Republicans here, they don't have an avatar. You do an invitation to the convention, if you ever received one of these, if you belong to a party, and there's always the biggest name in your party at the top of it. And if it's not Barack Obama, it was George W. Bush or who have you. Who's at the top of that photo for the Republicans right now? It's the curse of being the party out of power, magnified by the fact that you're in California where you don't have any statewide office holders. So you end up running rather anonymous fairs like this. So it'll be interesting to see if Kashkari and Donnelly can, you know, state a forum, not trash each other, or if somehow, you know, chaos does break out as it usually does.
Well, yeah, and the good thing about putting them at the last part is because all the various initiatives will have voted on. You know, what positions are we taking on this? What positions? And if they came on earlier, they themselves might have to take stands on these various things. So this way, they're out of it. You know, they're above the fray. But I do think there are a couple of heroes who come to the Republican. McCarthy, I imagine Kevin McCarthy will be there. And Darrell Issa, he's a hero to a lot of people. Remember, he put the first $2 million in to get rid of Ray Davis. And you know, activist Republicans, you know, aren't about to forget that. So I think you'll get a real hero's welcome for that reason, if no other.
And the answer question about Issa is, does he have any, what's the ceiling in California? There's a Senate race coming up here in 2016. I assume Barbara Boxer will run again. Who runs on the Republican side? Condoleezza Rice is speaking there, so you get the obligatory draft Condi run, but the problem there is that she gives a speech that's Reagan-esque, but she has a position on running which is Sherman-esque. Mm-hmm. She just will not do it. So someone like Dara Issa, you'll see her name thrown up there. The Republicans are scrounging for, you know, something as soon as 2016.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's part of the thing with these conventions, too. You start seeing things shaping up for the next time around.
Right.
We saw that with the Democrats,
right,
where, boy, Gavin Newsom was just all over the place at the Democratic convention, throwing huge parties on marriage equality, and I mean, he was in the spotlight. You could see where he's going for 2016, and
how was he received?
And they were hugely received. I mean,
what speaking slot did he get?
but then again, he joked about how Jerry Brown gave him the very last speaking slot at the convention, where about four people were left to hear him. however, he got his revenge. He got his revenge with the party that he threw. Was the sort of the toast of the town. And then we saw Kamala Harris there. It's very clear she was talking about human trafficking, other big issues, got lots of women behind her, had Nancy Pelosi at her side at a lot of events. It's clear to me she's running for governor, too.
Or is she going to run for U.S. Senate? Harris can go either way, it seems to me. Harris has got, you know, the gravitas to go for Senate or governor. I think Newsom can only go for governor.
Yeah.
You know, so if she wants governor, then...
Yeah, whatever happens, it's going to be a dogfight because, you know, both of these people have similar constituency, similar fundraising. That is going to be a harsh one, but that race is going to be a crowded race.
If you're a Giants fan, this is the equivalent of having about 8 starting pitchers going into a 5-man rotation. So you're looking at Gavin, you're looking at Kamala, Tom Steyer, who we haven't really talked about much in this discussion. They're very wealthy.
Also had a very big speaking.
Sheryl Sandberg.
Sheryl Sandberg has been talked about for 2016. Let's see, on top of that,
she's speaking here at the Commonwealth Club.
That's right.
Sold out, yeah. So
nice plug.
There
is Antonio Villaraigosa. There's Eric Garcetti, who replaced Villaraigosa as mayor of Los Angeles. So that's beyond your 5-man, 5-woman rotation right there. So that's beyond a bench, but that's problematic in that how do you herd people into right spots and don't get into these nasty little primary fights.
Here's a question. When is Nancy Pelosi retiring? Right to the point.
I don't know when she's retiring, but we've looked at and we've done stories about who would be likely to take her spot, and it seems very clear that Mark Leno is sort of the likely
Congress.
Yeah, in the House, because his district as a state senator almost completely tracks with hers, and he's very, very popular within that district, but that's going to be a competitive race, whatever happens.
But I think you're right. He's the one who's got the inside track. Yeah. But if there were, I would think if she had plans to retire in the short term, it would have been this time around. And if I'm Nancy Pelosi, I'm waiting until 2016 when I think my party can win not only the presidency, but I think that's their shot to get Congress back.
Exactly. If you're going to stick around in 2014 and take what very likely would be a beating, wait another 2 years, see if Hillary runs, see what the Republicans put up against Hillary, see if Hillary wins, see if Hillary sweeps in 20 or so Democrats, and you have the House back.
Well, we'll probably get to a few more political questions after our final topic, which is we generally don't do foreign policy here, but I wanted to kind of look at some of the domestic considerations of the situation in Ukraine. President Barack Obama has been predictably criticized for his approach to the Russian actions in the Crimea and massing troops along the border of Ukraine. Carla, is this just people who are not in power can snipe at him, or is he dithering?
The Republicans have been arguing that had Obama been stronger in foreign policy, this never would have happened. Is that what you're arguing? I think you can look at Putin's whole history going back more than a decade and say this is sort of the trajectory that he's been going for a long, long time. He's gotten away with a lot of things that in Georgia and really not a lot of outcry was raised. I thought it was interesting that just before we came on, CNN released a poll on this. More than half of Americans now, for the first time, believe a Cold War is going to break out again. They see the Russian actions very negatively. 70% of Americans, and Putin has seen very, very negatively now. I think you can argue that the $50 billion spent on the Olympics was basically flushed away. The goodwill was flushed away with these actions, and now, Obama has a question. Something has to be answered here, because there are other countries where there are significant Russian ethnic populations who have to be looking at this and saying, is it us next?
The problem is that there is very little he can do. There are sanctions, which largely are ineffective. They sound good, but they're largely ineffective. We have to realize that Crimea, Ukraine, and all these Eastern European countries, some more than others, are within the Russian sphere of influence. That's what it is. Hans Morgenthau used that term decades ago. And just like Canada and Mexico are within our sphere of influence, Latin America is. Even the Europeans don't really want to do much of anything when it comes to this action on the part of Putin. They've got commercial relationships. They've got gas, natural gas. Some of these countries, 100% of their gas comes right from the Ukraine and Russia. I mean, you know, they're not about to do that. Merkel is the one who needs to take the lead on this, and she's not about to do anything either.
She's talking tougher than she has in the past. The military intervention is off the table for the Europeans, but
there will be a feathers ruffled, for 6 months, and then it's all going to go away. You know, I mean, I think now if he invades the eastern part of Ukraine, mm-hmm. I think we're talking about a different ballgame at that point. Now we got people getting scared. But Crimea has always been one of those places that was touch and go. And I'm not suggesting that I approve of this, but there is something that we call realpolitik. And, you know, I don't think much is going to come out of it. It's going to happen.
On that happy note, let's get to some more questions. You mentioned Ted Cruz earlier. Ted Cruz was born in Canada. Can he even run for president? You can have a Kenyan president.
Show of hands, your favorite Canadian, Ted Cruz or Justin Bieber? Which I think, by the way, is the best joke I saw about the U.S.-Canada hockey game. Loser gets Bieber. Can he run for president? I believe he can. I believe he'll try to. This came up with John McCain, actually, when McCain was running for president, because McCain was born in the Canal Zone, I believe. So they got around that. So, yeah, I believe he's running. God help us.
George Romney was born in Mexico.
Mexico, right.
When his parents were missionaries. I mean, there are always these unusual circumstances, but in the end, I think the courts, if it went to the courts, would even say, yeah, he can run. You might remember that they actually passed a resolution in Congress when McCain was it Romney or McCain? McCain was questioned. Yeah. And the Congress said, of course he can run. Now, that didn't have the effect of law, but I think it said something about the spirit of the whole thing, what people felt.
Okay. Yeah. I think this is kind of directed for you, Larry, because you were talking about off-year turnout and such. Democrats don't bother to vote in large enough numbers unless there is an attractive candidate or a big issue. What can the Democratic Party do? I'm assuming repealing Prop 209 is not their idea of the...
Well, it's kind of interesting. You know, in voting behavior, there's all this literature out there, you know, that says the first thing you do is reinforce the base. The second thing you do is activate people who haven't made up their minds. And the third thing you do is try to convert. You spend much more of your energy on the first, less on the second, hardly any on the third. The Obama people seem to think what they can do is go to that middle group, the group that are sort of like, you know, apathetic one way or another, and mobilize them, which is really going against all kinds of literature. But you know, if they can do that, you know, in some states, they can probably raise a participation. But I remind you once again that 50% of the House districts are gerrymandered by Republicans for Republican candidates, 10% of the congressional districts for Democrats, the rest by independent commissions. So, I mean, the deck is, I hate to use this word, kind of stacked.
It is. Stuart Rothenberg is a political handicapper in Washington. Of the 435 seats in the House, he says 52 he would describe as competitive. That's 52 out of 435. And he's being kind. I think that's 28 Republican and 24 Democratic, or the other way around. So Larry's right. It's an absolutely small margin you're playing with. But again, the challenge for the Democrats is Barack Obama was wildly successful in 2012, making that election a defense of Barack Obama, turning out his base to defend the president, stand up for the president. Is awfully hard in 2014 to do the same because it's other people running and not Barack Obama.
And he's had a not great year in 2013.
No, not a good year. It's also a very interesting question as to where he will go when he campaigns. Also a very interesting question is where Hillary will go when she'll campaign. And a really interesting question also is to where Chris Christie will go to campaign, because Chris Christie has another job in addition to the day job in New Jersey. He's the chairman of the Republican Governors Association, which sounds trivial, but it actually means that he possesses about $100 million in campaign money, and he could go around the country and engage in governor's races and pick favorites. And, oh, by the way, there's a governor's race in Iowa. There's a governor's race in New Hampshire. There's a governor's race in South Carolina, a governor's race in Nevada. Rumor has it there's one here in California, too. He can go into states that will benefit him in 2016 and start engaging.
Bill, would you say Chris Christie is over? I mean, what's your thoughts on that? Because we have, by the way, you know, another Republican presidential potential coming here into the Bay Area next week with Rand Paul coming to Berkeley. And I think he's going to get a very big turnout in Berkeley.
I don't know if he's over. I think picking front runners for 2016 at this point, it's like speed dating. You have a 1 minute introduction, bang, you ring the bell, and next person comes along. And it was that way with Christie. It's that way now with Rand Paul. 2 months from now, it may be that way with Jeb Bush or Paul Ryan. We go through these cycles. I don't think Christie's moment has passed, but I think the challenge he has this is you look at the Republican circles, and there is a group that I call smart money. And these are people who aren't so much motivated by passion. They're realpolitik, and they decide, okay, which of these people could get me 270 electoral votes? Which of these people can get elected? Christie held that position as of a couple months ago. The person you may be looking now, and Larry can explain this very well, is Jeb Bush.
Yeah, Jeb Bush. I think Jeb Bush is somebody who's just waiting in the wings. He's just waiting for everybody to knock each other out, waiting for everybody to make ludicrous statements as they all fight to say something unique, and in the process bury themselves. And he's just sitting back chuckling. And I think it's a really wise place for him to be. I just do. And if the guy just waits, now you want a grown-up to run here now? Are you ready for somebody, with some weight here? And I can see him doing things that Republicans don't do very often. He'll pick and choose the primaries. He doesn't need a lot of them, He can come in not late, but he can certainly come in after all this stuff's gone on. And, sometime April, May of 2015, well, okay, too many people have said to me, I've got to do this for the good of my country, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I can see it. I can see it, and I think that would be good. I do want to say one thing about the vote for the Democrats in 2014. I think what Obama has to do, and I don't think he will do it, he has to run, he has to refer to the House as the do-nothing Congress. He has to say, I've been accused of not doing this, not doing this, not doing this. No, I put the proposals. They've said no, 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 no. It's a do-nothing Congress, and you've got a choice of putting up with them for 2 more years or kicking them out. And I don't think he has it inside. I just don't. He's too much of a let's work things out kind of guy.
He's not Bill Clinton.
Yeah, he's not Bill Clinton.
Bill, if you're the fill-in for Deborah, this is your point to step in and say, he hasn't reached out to the Republicans at all.
Exactly. By the way, to close out on the Bush front, in Texas last week, George P. Bush,
yes, that's right.
The nephew of the former president and the son of Jeb, won the primary for Texas Land Commissioner. So write this down for the 2028 or 2032 presidential candidate, George P. Bush versus Chelsea Clinton. Bring it on.
Okay, one last question before we get to the news quiz. This goes actually back to one of our much earlier topics. Fracking and Governor Brown. One person wrote in to say, you had used the idea of, it's on one side producers and consumers, and the other side is environmentalists. There's a lot of washover between, for example, the consumers and the environmentalists. Does this kind of go back to the issue of, yes, but how, is it a voting issue for you, or is it just an issue you have an opinion on?
I think, fracking is sort of like the peripheral tunnel. I think it's an issue for some people. Mm-hmm. I think, there are a lot of us who are one-issue candidates.
Yeah.
Fracking, the Delta, mm-hmm. Choice, marijuana. And for people like that, I think this will rise to the surface, and it will force them to change, and they may vote against Jerry Brown, for example. But I don't think fracking rises to the surface as a big issue for most people. I just think it's too out there. It's just not yet. Nobody feels affected. Nobody. Few people feel really affected by it. Right. So that's why I think it's, for the time being, it's.
Yeah, I look at it. I look at it from the lawmaker's standpoint, and I look at it from a moral standpoint, because what fracking and marijuana legalization have in common? A lot of money for the state, potentially, revenue. So you're a lawmaker, and you're looking at fracking and saying, am I willing to maybe play a little fast and loose with the environment if it means a big gusher of money coming into California? If I'm looking at marijuana legalization, I'm saying, am I willing to have a big gusher of money coming to California if maybe we're kind of raising a new generation of potheads in California? So it's kind of your internal compass and what you're willing to abide by.
Yeah, but, kidding aside, this is the most environmentally minded state in the union.
Right.
We are a trendsetter, whether it's automobile exhaust, whether it's a cap and trade. Other states look to us. We'll talk about the experimental states. This state is out there more than anybody else, and I just don't know how quickly legislators are about to go in the other direction on that. Because that's the larger issue. That's not just fracking. That's the whole environmental protection issue.
Yeah, and I've never heard the phrase pragmatic environmentalist. So.
Yeah, and I think there's potential for division here, because we did see some speakers at the Democratic Convention say, you know what, I know they're saying climate change is the big thing, but it's economic inequality that is the biggest issue to our grassroots voters. You're going to see some, I think, debate among Democrats about where they want to put their priorities.
Did Gavin say anything about that during his party?
Well, yeah, no, not at the party.
I don't think it'll be a Sheryl Sandberg issue either.
Yeah, that could be a Sheryl Sandberg issue.
Okay. Well, let's do our news quiz. And do I have my volunteer here? I needed my volunteer who will be delivering the prize to the winner. So
this is your Vanna White.
Oh, it's a prize.
Yes, Vanna, thank you. I'm going to read the question. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand. I'll point to you and shout it out. If you win, you will get a nice little bag of chocolate. That's not all for you.
Yes.
I said so. Okay, let's start off with foreign policy. Who warned Russia that retaliation from the West for Russia's actions in Ukraine would be a, quote, catastrophe that would cause massive damage to Russia economically and politically? Mm. Sir?
Obama?
No. Though so he might
agree with it.
I think he agrees with it, but someone...
said it.
In the back?
No. Let me give you a hint. This is someone who is very reticent to be taking a tough line of things. And I'm sorry, you, ma'am. You are correct. First winner, Angela Merkel of Germany. Okay, second question. The tech world celebrated 25 years of what this year? And ma'am, I saw your hand first. The World Wide Web, that's right. The woman in the white sweater. Happy birthday.
Mm-hmm.
That's how long some of us have been waiting on tech support. Okay, what caused flight MH370 to disappear on a flight from Malaysia to China?
You know.
Very good. I thought I would go through like 20 people offering suggestions, but we do not know. It is not known. It gets more mysterious as we go on. Did you see the gentleman in the light blue? Okay. This one, however, has an actual answer. Tragedy struck what event when a car drove into a crowd of people this week? And, sir, in the back of the pillar. South by Southwest Festival in Austin, Texas. That's right. Two people were killed and quite a few injured. What did Attorney General Eric Holder come out in support of this week? I'm going to go with someone who hasn't yet answered, sir.
I think lighter sentences for drug abuse.
Right, specifically for nonviolent drug offenders. So you are correct, lighter sentences. And in the latest state-level ruling on gay marriage, what did a county judge in Alabama rule on Wednesday? Did anyone see this story? This was a case brought by a couple who had married in Iowa, way in the back. That's right. It was a couple who had been married in Iowa, moved to Alabama, a same-sex couple moved to Alabama, and they said, you can't divorce because Alabama doesn't recognize that you were ever married. Next question. Why was this week significant for Pope Francis? Sorry, I saw her in the back first. That's right. 1 year as Pope. Well, for another question, what did Oscar Pistorius, the so-called Blade Runner athlete, what did he do during his trial? He actually did it twice. And you, sir? He broke down in tears. He also threw up twice when they were describing the wounds to his girlfriend. So, ma'am, the gentleman in the tan jacket. Okay. What did President Obama order his labor secretary to do? Ma'am in the blue. Right. Just to revamp the overtime pay, change the rules. You see her in the blue? Okay. And final question, my favorite question. Not because it's the final one. the topic. What 34-year-old television program was just revived by Fox? They aired it on like 10 different channels. Ma'am, right there? You are correct. Cosmos was a series that aired back in 1980 with Carl Sagan. And Neil deGrasse Tyson, who has spoken on this stage a number of times, is hosting the new series. That's right. Yeah. Hopefully we'll have him back soon to give his more of his great commentary. I want to thank all of you for coming and joining us today. And thanks to our panel, Carla Marinucci, Dr. Larry Gersten, and Bill Whalen. Thanks to everyone in our audience, everyone watching and listening to us online. Everyone have a great weekend.